death, burial, and his resurrection. And I was thinking, as Doug was speaking to us this morning, we sang the song, Tell Me the Story of Jesus. And that's exactly what he did, telling us the story of Jesus. Thank you, Doug, so much for that. I appreciate your comments, Alan, getting us started this morning, helping us to see that we are much like Peter, but the Lord loved him and believed in him and did great things through him. And he can do great things through us as well. Our hearts are very heavy this morning as we continue to think deeply about Jan Satterfield. As we have been told, hospice has been called in, and they don't know how long this will stretch out, but she is believed to be in her last days, and so let's be mindful of her as God eases her across Jordan, and pray for Ferris and all of the family as well. Ferris has preached a strong sermon for a while now. I know it's, in my case, it's a sermon that's been preached for 3 years at least. Maybe longer. I don't know when all this started, but I appreciate the lesson that he is preaching every day by his devotion to her. And we'll talk more about that in a way in this morning's lesson, at least allude to that in a way. Good to see Marvin and Ravina today. They have not been able to be with us for a long time. It really is good to see you. And I know it must feel good to you to be out as well. We know that this means to some degree that you turn the corner, but we understand that it's not completed yet. So our prayers are with you that you'll continue to gain strength each and every day. With me now to Mark chapter 1. We're walking to the city of Capernaum, which is where we were last in my preaching upon the life of Jesus. I've been seeking to preach from the life of Christ fairly often, because really what we're trying to do is to understand that he left us an example that we should follow in his steps. Christianity in its purest form is nothing more than seeing Jesus and imitating the one that we see. And so I believe that by preaching on him, we come to know him better, we come to know his character. He's the heart of it all, and it will certainly help us to become more and more like him. The last time we were with Jesus, Jesus had come to the city of Capernaum, and he went into a synagogue there, and there was a man who had an unclean spirit. And Jesus cast the unclean spirit out of this man. The reaction of the people was great. They said, "What new doctrine is this? For with authority he commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." What in the world are we witnessing in what we're seeing about him? And word about that, Jesus healing this man of this unclean spirit, word about that just spread like wildfire throughout the region, so that Jesus is now going to be so very busy in Galilee. In fact, what I'm going to be speaking on this morning all happened in one day, where Jesus has a tremendously busy day. Then following him as a rabbi was not going to be easy. It's not easy. And may I say this, it wasn't easy for the families of Peter and James and John and all of those men as well. Does Jesus see Peter's family? Does Jesus see Peter's wife? For that matter, does he see my wife? Sure he does. Let's notice now in Mark chapter 1, we pick up in verse 29. It says, "As soon as they had come out of the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. But Simon's wife's mother lay sick with a fever, and they told him about her at once. And so he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and immediately the fever left her, and she served him." But we sometimes forget that Peter had a wife. Peter had a wife. And it hit me in this text that it could have said that he came to the place of Simon's mother-in-law. But I noticed that that was not the wording. The wording was, he came to the place of Simon's wife's mother. And so not only is this an emphasis on her mother, but this is an emphasis on Peter's wife. Peter has made a tremendous sacrifice to follow the Lord. But I think we need to understand that any is going to involve her as well. Any sacrifice he makes will also be hers. And I am assuming from what all I know about her, and even what secular history has said about her, that she is so proud of her husband. But because of his decision to follow the rabbi, Jesus has now come into her life in a major way. Peter, in making the decision that he has made, has brought Jesus into her home. And there is no doubt that she has to be so thankful that Jesus is at the center of her husband's life. Jesus is at the center of her life. According to Eusebius, she herself later died as a martyr, with her husband looking on and encouraging her to remember the Lord. But you know, her willingness to be a martyr for the Lord did not come without hardship. She faced a lot of hardship in her life, I'm convinced, just by her husband being away as much as he was away. No doubt there had to be times when Peter's wife was lonely. I can imagine a number of times when she was worried about how her husband was doing as they're roaming about the hillside doing their preaching and teaching and facing enemies here and there. And I might venture to say that there might have been times when she might have felt a bit neglected. But Jesus sees her. Jesus knows her needs. And he values Peter's wife as an indispensable part of this mission. Do we understand that Peter cannot do what he does without her? And I have to say that as a preacher, I feel this a lot of times myself. I don't know that I could ever help you all to understand just how much I think about you. I don't think I could put into words how much time this family in Danville Road is on my mind. I don't think I could adequately tell you just how much I want to see every one of you grow and to be more and more and more like Jesus, and to be a part of that myself, and to be trying to do everything that I can possibly do to help us all to grow into the stature of the fullness of Jesus Christ. I want you to be like Jesus. I want this place to be full of devoted disciples, and so that takes a lot of time. But you know, there's a lady at home who needs her husband. Jesus sees you, Susan. And Linda, Jesus sees you. And Deb, Jesus sees you. And may I say, Jesus sees all of you wives who are making tremendous sacrifices to do what they do. In the case of many of you young ladies, it's even more than the time that I would be away. It's more than the time that Don would be away or that Doug would be away. How many days do you spend without your husband in your home? And yet you press on and you encourage him and you try to handle the affairs that must be handled, that really surely must be much easier when he is at home. But I want you to know that Jesus sees you. And he loves you. And you are an indispensable part of this thing. And I think Jesus helps them to realize that on this occasion. And what I have to do is I have to do a better job balancing ministry and not neglecting the ministry that I have within the walls of my home. Not neglecting the things that need to be taken care of. As I continue this wonderful journey of going through life with my wife. And so Jesus, as he goes into this situation, he doesn't want to worry Peter. He doesn't need a worried Peter who's all worried about his wife and worried about his mother-in-law. And so he doesn't want her to feel unnoticed. And so what Jesus does here is he gives her a wonderful gift. Her mother is laying there with a fever. He comes and takes her by the hand and lifts her up. And one of Mark's favorite words is immediately. picture her just hopping up and immediately getting about the business of serving these people. There's nothing wrong with her, not anymore. Jesus has taken all of that away instantly. And I want you to see that. I want you to see him take her mother by the hand, lift her up, see the fever, leave her, and then serve like she has never been sick. Getting busy serving them all. Doing what he did in the synagogue. Now going into this situation and the emotions of it and bringing life back to her. Not that she had died, but giving her vitality once again. It's been a busy day already. But let me tell you, it's going to turn into an even busier night. Look at verse 32. Now at evening, when the sun had set. Can you picture it? At evening when the sun had set, they brought to him all who were sick and those who were demon-possessed. And the whole city was gathered together, healed many who were sick with various diseases. He cast out many demons, and he did not allow them to leave him. Estimates are that the city of Capernaum had about 1,500 people during the time of Jesus. And this verse said that on this night, after he's done all that he's done already today, the whole city gathers together at the door. Can you just see all those people trying to get inside the door? And this one's got this problem, and this one's got that problem, and this one's got another problem, and they're all wanting a piece of Jesus. I don't know how many people that is, but it said many. It was many. I thought about Alex and Erica, and I hope I'm not missing somebody else who's in this field, but I'd be interested to know how many patients you see in a day. On your busiest day, how many you see? It's got to be a lot. And I just know that at the end of the day, it's just, wow, you know. But I venture to say that out of 1,500 people in a city, and all of the sick, and all of the demon-possessed are coming, how many did Jesus see? And I want you to notice the wording of Luke. Would you turn to Luke chapter 4 and verse 40 as Luke describes this? In Luke chapter 4 and verse 40, it simply says in Luke 4 and verse 40 that when the sun was set, all those who had anyone who was sick with various diseases brought them to him, and he laid his hands on every one of them and healed them. Can you just see Jesus one by one? He works with this one for a moment. And then he works with this one for a moment. It doesn't take long for that to add up. That's why when I go to funerals at a visitation, I try to only just briefly say my thoughts are with you. Because I've realized that if every person talks 1 minute to the person you're trying to comfort, if it's 60 people in the line, that takes an hour. If it's 120, that takes 2 hours. If it's 200, it takes 3 hours. How long did it take Jesus to do this? And I want you to do this. I want you to take this moment where he didn't tell us all about each one. It just said that they brought all that were sick and he laid hands on every one of them. Take that and add that to all of the other ones that Jesus did tell us about. How big would our Bibles be if God had tried to tell us about every single one of these? All I know is that in John chapter 20, chapter 21, as John closes his gospel, it says in verse 25, and there are also many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. I know that's hyperbole, but I don't think it's far beyond the stretch to understand the world couldn't contain the books that would be written if God had told us about every single one of them. Folks, he did miracles in bucket loads. Eric read to us that they said in John 7, well, I don't know what you think about this man, but I more signs than this man's done? Pray tell how many he would do if this is not the Messiah. Jesus doing this in abundance. This is vintage Jesus. Can we just tuck this away? He is putting their needs above his own. No doubt he is totally, totally, totally exhausted when this day is done. Have you ever had a day when you just could not wait to get into bed? I mean, like maybe you're trying to get home or and you're just like, man, I cannot wait to get into bed. And I'm a big teeth brusher. I brush my teeth about 3 times a day. But you know, on those times, sometimes you just say, forget it. I'm going to bed. Jesus, no doubt, has a day like that. My pillow is going to feel so good. He needs rest. And I want to point out something else that I think is very important here. Could God have made us when we did not have limits? Sure. God had made us where we could just go and 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 go. Don't forget sleep. You don't need sleep. God could have made us with no limits. Limits was his idea, and every one of us have them. Your limit may be different than mine, but everybody has limits. Jesus had a lot of load on this day. But one of the things that you will do if you look at Scripture is Jesus always encouraged margin. And what I mean by margin is this. There's your load, and then there's your limit. What Jesus wants us to do is to stop short of our limit. Stop short of your limit. Have you some space where you can just kind of go, that's why he encouraged rest and valued rest. Because when we go running past our limits for an extended amount of time, that's when we crash and burn. And so Jesus encourages rest, and you're going to see that he gets it here in just a moment. No doubt he slept some this night. I'm convinced he got a little. And no doubt it did him a lot of good. But here's the next thing that I want you to see. He forfeits some sleep for prayer. I wouldn't have blamed him if he had just decided to sleep in the next day. Who would have? But look at what he does. Picking up now in Mark chapter 1, we pick up in verse 35. Now in the morning, having risen a long while before daylight, he went out and departed to a solitary place. And there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and when they found him, they said, everyone's looking for him. He said, then let us go into the next town so that I may preach there also, because for this purpose I have come forward. And he was preaching in their synagogues throughout all Galilee, and casting out demons. Jesus rises early the next morning. Why? Well, I think we know the reason why. He has got to get up. If he wants any time with his Father, he has got to get up. Because after they wipe the sleep out of their eyes pretty good, they're going to go, let's go find Jesus. They're going to be all over him. And so because he knows that, he has to get up before they do. He has to get up before they do. And I like that. I love traveling early. I really like traveling when there's hardly anybody on the highways. And I don't know, it's just kind of a peaceful time. I really like that. But he goes out to this solitary place, and it's here that he can have communion and intimacy with his Father. Let me say something. As disciples of Jesus, we need to learn to enjoy solitude. We need to get comfortable with solitude because, frankly, most Americans aren't. Most Americans want noise. Even if they're in the house and they're not even watching it, they want a radio on or they want TV on because we don't like quiet. There's something about it that's just kind of unnerving to Americans. In fact, when I have traveled abroad, people have warned me, you know, be careful because they know an American when they see one. I said, how? They said, you're noisy. Americans are noisy. Jesus is telling us that we need to learn that that secret time is powerful time. Because let me tell you, when I'm in a moment like this, I will verbalize things to God that I do not verbalize publicly. I will say things to God privately that I don't say publicly. And it's easier for me to see myself in these moments because there's not anybody but me, God. So the focus is on Him, and the focus also comes back on me. And it's certainly not being done in a show because nobody knows. One of my favorite quotes about solitude is that solitude is like an anesthetic. Solitude is like an anesthetic that puts everything to sleep so surgery can take place. That's beautiful. I know that in my private time, God has performed surgery on me. There have been things that I have willingly cut out of my life that I could see in my quiet time. But for me to see that, I had to get speed. If you're going to have a surgery, they put you under so you won't move around while they're doing delicate work. And so God gets me still. And you have this great communion with Him, but also the good things that He will do in your life. And if you have not enjoyed that or developed that, please do. There is nothing like it. It occurs to me here that His leaving caught them by surprise. They're like, where's Jesus? But you got to remember, this was very early on in His ministry. So initially, this is something that's like, well, where'd He go? But you will find that they get used to that. They will get used to that over the next couple of years or so, because when Luke records about Jesus, Luke says in chapter 5 and verse 16 that Jesus Himself would often slip away. I love that rendering. Jesus would often slip away. I'm indebted to a preacher friend of mine, Ralph Walker, for this illustration. Have any of you ever slipped away? Maybe you went to some kind of event that you really didn't want to go to. But you really felt like, you know, you had an obligation to go. And so you want to make an appearance, but you just don't really want to stay long. What do you do? Well, you show up. And then after you've done your greetings and well wishes and all that other, you just kind of ease over here, maybe a few feet away from the door. And you kind of look around, you see if anybody's looking. If they're not looking, you ease a little closer to the door. And then if they're not looking, you ease a little closer to the door. And then you might even put your hand on the doorknob and you take one last look. And if nobody's looking, slip away. You don't say, hey everybody, I just want you to know I'm going to slip away. That's not how that works. And so it got to where if they woke up or they looked around and Jesus wasn't around and it looked like He had just disappeared, we know where He's at. He'll be back. Don't worry about it. We know what He's doing. Because that became His custom. This was Jesus' lifestyle. And I want to say something to you again about the importance of routine. Jackie was telling me that she runs on routines. I get that. But if you're going to make prayer a lifestyle of yours, you've got to have a certain time. When is your time? I'm not saying you don't do it other times, but do you have a predictable time that you're going to pray to God? If it's going to become a lifestyle, you need a certain time. And you need a certain place. Where is the most common place of solitude, quiet, where you gather to talk to God? You need a time, you need a place, and you need a certain place. The disciples said, Lord, teach us to pray. art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Forgive us our debts. He gave them a plan. I'll tell you one that has worked well for me that I like. A-C-T-S. It's easy to remember because it's Acts. Acts. The A stands for adoration. In that part of the prayer, I'm doing nothing more than praising God. The C stands for confession. In that period, I'm confessing my sins and thanking God for the blood of Jesus to cleanse me. The T stands for thanksgiving. That's when I'm thanking God for His many things. And the S stands for supplication, where I'm asking God to supply certain things to me and supply certain things to others. I need a time. I need a place. I need a plan to develop a lifestyle of prayer. And you may be sitting there, preacher, you just don't know my life. I'm just so busy. I just don't have time to pray. And my answer to that is, my friend, you don't have time not to pray. If you're busy, it's all the more reason to pray. Because I tell you what I found. When I pray about my day, it just sort of has a way of gliding a lot better than it would. I don't have time to pray. No, you don't have time not to pray. It's a lifestyle of prayer. I love it that Jesus did not, when they came to him and said, everybody's seeking you. He didn't say, oh, let me go right back into that crest of popularity. No, he doesn't ride a crest of popularity. He doesn't care so much about this mere popularity. He's on a mission to preach and teach. Let us go into the next town. And then I want to finish right here. Jesus went from place of prayer to place of prayer with miracles and teaching in his place. That's another one of my favorite quotes. Really, when you think about it, he was always wanting to be along with God. And so he would do that. And then he would go do some miracles and some teaching. But he's always going to come back to prayer. He goes from place of prayer to place of prayer with miracles and teaching in between. I think that shows his life really well. And then we finish right here. In verse 40, then a leper came to him, imploring him, kneeling down to him, and saying to him, if you are willing, you can make me clean. And Jesus, moved with compassion, put out his hand and touched him, and said to him, I am willing, be cleansed. And as soon as he had spoken, immediately the leprosy left him, and he was cleansed. And he strictly warned him and sent him away at once, and said, see that you say nothing to anyone, but go your way and show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing those things which Moses commanded as a testimony to them. But he went out and began to proclaim it freely and to spread the matter, so that Jesus could no longer openly enter the city, but was outside in deserted places. And they came to him from every quarter. First thing I want to say is Jesus touched him. Listen, folks, leprosy is awful. I read this. Leprosy begins as small red spots on the skin. Before too long, the spots get bigger and they start to turn white with a shiny or scaly appearance. The spots soon spread over the body and hair begins to fall out, first from the head and then from the eyebrows. As things get worse, fingernails and toenails become loose. They start to rot and they eventually fall off. Then the joints of the fingers and toes begin to rot and fall off piece by piece. Gums begin to shrink, and they can't hold the teeth anymore, so each tooth is lost. Leprosy keeps eating away at the face until the nose, the palate, and even the eyes rot, and the leper will waste away until he or she dies. Awful. But I want to tell you, I think something else is about as bad as a leper. Nobody wants to touch him. He can't touch his wife. He can't touch his kids. He feels like scum. And I think Jesus knew on this occasion that one thing this man needs as much as me healing him is he needs to be touched. Jesus is good at touching people, isn't he? He's good at touching people. And Jesus touched him. I told you. storm with him. They said he's got leprosy. He's crying out for people to stay away from him. And so Gary started making his way over there, and the boy began to protest. And Gary got closer, and he protests some more. And he got right up there to him, and tears are running down the kid's eyes, and Gary holds out his hand and says, "Take my kid. Touch me." Now, I'm not saying that that was good to do. I'm not saying that the hospital's got quarantine on the door, but you already ignored it. I'm not saying that, but I am saying that that kid was blessed by a man's touch. Sometimes we need people's skin on us. But Jesus needs us. And we need to touch more people too. I mean that in a generic sense. We need to feel their situation. And I want to leave you with this. Jesus did not get what the leper had. Instead, the leper got what he had. And what a wonderful thing it was on this day. And you know, I find it so interesting. Jesus told this man, "Don't tell anybody." And he went out and began to proclaim the freedom. The irony of that is, Jesus told him not to tell, and he tells everybody. He's told us to tell. Why not proclaim freely what the Lord has done for you? It's the only way to get people to come. If you ask people who are now Christians how they became Christians, you'll be surprised the number of them will say, I was in Bible. So as is yours, you need to respond to the gospel. Would you surrender all? Would you come giving your life, laying down your sins, repenting, confessing Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of God, and being baptized to have your sins washed away in His blood, buried in your old man?